and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at several big stories. First, our regular economic segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Today, we'll talk about the Federal Reserve's pessimistic forecast about the future of the U.S. economy and much more. And then we continue our regular segment, which we do every Tuesday, called Women and Society with Dr. Hannah Dickinson and Nicole Roussel. In this weekly segment, we talk about the major issues, challenges, and struggles facing women in all aspects of society. Today, we focus on the Justice Department's decision to seek the repeal of the Affordable Care Act in its entirety. How will this affect women and families, and what kind of health care do we really need?
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Authorities in Chicago have dropped all charges against actor Jussie Smollett. Smollett was accused of staging a hate crime to secure a higher salary for his work on the hit TV show Empire, but prosecutors have now admitted that there was insufficient evidence to charge him in the first place. Smollett said in a statement today, quote, "I would like nothing more than to just get back to work and move on with my life. But make no mistake, I will always continue to fight for the justice, equality, and betterment of marginalized people everywhere," unquote. Ahmed Gaid Salah, the head of the Algerian army, has called for the end of President Abdelaziz Bouteflika's presidency. Salah said that Bouteflika should be declared unfit for office. Mass protests have broken out in recent weeks in Algeria against the prospect of another term in office for Bouteflika and in favor of deep political reforms. 13 civilians, including 10 children, were killed in a U.S. airstrike today in Afghanistan. It took place during an intense battle with Taliban fighters in the province of Kunduz. Information about the airstrike was made public by the United Nations. Bill Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts, announced today that he would make a decision in April about whether or not to challenge Donald Trump in the 2020 Republican primary. Weld said, quote, "I'm leaning toward doing it unless something changes," unquote. Weld is considered to be a centrist Republican. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the U.S. economy. Today, we are going to continue our weekly series, False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel joins us from San Francisco. He's a financial policy analyst. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, lots of economic news this week, both at the macro level and the micro level. One thing I think we both want to start with is news about auto sales and car loans. What can you tell us?
Yeah, I think this was really important to talk about because I think many of the listeners are at least somewhat familiar with the 2008 financial crisis around the mortgage industry. And why I think it's important to talk about these things is we're seeing actually a lot of similarities. It's just now we're not talking about mortgages, we're talking about auto loans. So recently, it was reported that auto sales are declining, especially cheaper auto sales are declining significantly, and they're seeing a lot less people buying cheaper cars and instead buying used cars or just not buying cars at all. And concurrently, they've also seen auto prices balloon. So more expensive cars are being produced and productive capacity for cheaper cars is being scaled back. So basically, cars are costing more and people are buying less of them, which makes sense. I mean, if things are more expensive, people can't afford them. So that, I think, can be traced back to a number of factors. I think one of them is definitely the trade war. Auto industry manufacturers made it very clear that if all these tariffs were going to be put on China, it would disrupt their trade lines and their productive capacity and cause all kinds of price increases, which it most certainly has. So I think that definitely has to do with part of it. I think also the tariffs make it much less profitable to produce cheaper cars. So they're scaling back production of those. And then, you know, your average working people can't afford luxury vehicles quite like they used to. So we're seeing this kind of happening where there's a softening of the auto sales market. But then concurrently, and we kind of reported on this a couple of weeks ago, we're seeing a record number of Americans defaulting on their auto loans. So that means 7 million Americans are 90 days or more delinquent on their auto loans. So not only are autos not being purchased at the same pace because of price, people aren't actually being able to pay them back in quite the same way. And so I kind of dug into that and looked at why, you know, that might be. And I think there's some interesting things to point out. First of all, the auto loan industry is huge. It's $1.3 trillion as of 2018. So it's big. There's a lot of money out there. And it really skyrocketed over the last 2 years from $800 billion to $1.3 trillion. So we saw this big increase. And what we also see in that industry is that it's much lighter touch regulation. So we don't see as many defaults in credit cards and mortgages because the regulatory space is more strict. So in other words, you can't loan shark out. You can't make as risky a loans. You have to have more qualified buyers. You have to have a more robust underwriting process so that people who can't afford the loans are going to be taken advantage of them, don't get the loans. But in auto loans, it's a little less so. It's not nearly as regulatorily strict. There's a lot more opportunities to have loans underwater where the value of the loan is less than the value of the car. That's pretty common, especially as they're buying more expensive luxury vehicles. And a lot of these purchases were really financed by the auto loan industry. So that is to say, it wasn't so much that consumers had all this extra buying power and were buying more expensive cars. It was that they were being able to take out loans.
Let me interrupt you on that point, because I think that's very important. So you have people buying cars, whether new or used, and most of those cars are being financed by the companies selling you the car. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
So you're paying them now a higher rate of interest because interest rates have gone up over the last 18 months. And then if you default, they get their car back and they sell it to somebody else.
Exactly. And think about the regulatory problems there. What a conflict of interest for this person to be selling you this car and also the financing for it at the same time. You know, they have all the incentives in the world to make really unfavorable loan terms, or maybe even have loan terms where the intention is for you to default later so they can get the car back and then, I don't know, maybe rent it out, maybe sell it to a car rental place, maybe, you know, who knows, sell it as a used car or something like that in another loan, right? And start collecting interest that way. So that's a huge part of it. And you mentioned, John, the rising interest rates. That's a really important part of it because now these really cheap, well, and I put cheap in air quotes, loans, because they are cheap at least up front, but in the long term, you end up paying a lot more, are going up even more in price. And so that cash that was that kind of false cash, that money loaned from banks, isn't as plentiful as it once was. So the buying power of these consumers aren't the same as it once was. So what we're seeing is kind of a similar economic mix to what we saw in 2008, where you have this ballooning industry. It was poorly regulated. It got huge. People were given loans they really shouldn't have been given that, you know, took advantage of them. And then there was an economic change, right? There was the tide turned. So in this case, we're talking about the trade war in China. We're talking about the Fed raising the rates. And all of a sudden, we start seeing cracks in the armor. All of a sudden, this cheap credit that buoyed up everything isn't cheap anymore and isn't as plentiful. And I think that's huge because that's a lot of what we saw in 2008, where all of a sudden the bubble burst and suddenly all this kind of cheap, practically free money that people could get access to easily ran out. And people had to pay back the loan. And all of a sudden, they couldn't because all the wealth was kind of artificial. So that's a big part of what we're seeing here with this auto loan kind of bubble starting to burst. And it's a big one. You know, it's $1.3 trillion. That's a lot of money. And that can significantly impact the economy. That's not just a blip.
And not to make light of this, I know Brian wants to weigh in here too. Not to make light of this, but this is what crack dealers do, right? They'll sell you crack for whatever, $5, $2. Maybe they'll give you a free rock. And they get you hooked, and then they jack the price up. That's exactly what these auto dealers are doing, where they'll offer you cheap money, maybe even free money, until you're hooked on it, and then you can't make the payments, and then you lose everything, and they take your car back too.
Yeah. I'll give you a personal example. 2 years ago, my car was having trouble, and so I took it to see what it would cost to repair the car. So the dealer said, look, we'll sell you a new car, and I said, well, I don't want to buy a whole new car. And they said, well, look at the interest rate we're giving you. This was about 3 years ago, actually. Interest rates were basically at zero. And so the offer that they gave me was a 5-year loan on my new car. And the amount of interest that I would have to pay per month was $7 per month on interest.
Oh, my gosh.
Right?
Yeah, who wouldn't do that?
So Brian Pecker did it.
Sure.
Of course I did it. And I got a new car and I was actually paying less per month than I was with the old car. That's the thing about cheap credit. It's basically, now, by the way, for everybody, just so that we don't think that this is normal. It's the banks that are basically getting free credit from the Federal Reserve all the time and have what's called quantitative easing since 2008. They've just been given all of this money with actually zero interest or almost zero interest, and they've taken that money and they've used it to buy stocks. That's why stocks went up. That's why we have a stock market bubble way, way, way beyond the actual earnings of the corporations that people are buying stocks with. But here again, Daniel, this is typical of the capitalist boom-bust cycle. At the beginning of the cycle, credit is easy. And then that begins the process of sales and the process of production. And the economy starts to hum and it hums. And then it starts to what's called boom and it expands. And everyone gets very wide-eyed about the possibilities. And it seems to go on and on. And it's everything's working. Until, in fact, you have to pay loans back. And also because workers are not being paid that which they actually create in terms of values, they can't buy back all in aggregate, all that they've produced, and other factors that lead to the crisis of overproduction and credit starts to tighten. And it's more expensive to get a loan, more expensive to pay back a loan. And as a consequence, when people can't, let's say if you're a small business person, not just a consumer, you took out a loan at almost no rate or a low rate, and then maybe the rate goes up after a few years. It's all premised on your ability to pay the loan back. And if you can't sell products at a certain point because the market has become glutted, in other words, there's been too many products that have been produced then can be sold at a profit, you can't sell. And if you can't sell, you can't pay your loan back. And that's what creates the global generalized phenomena of recessions or depressions, however you want to call it.
Exactly right. And it's all based on speculation, right? These loans are made, they're investments in people. And the speculation is, yeah, we think in 5 years you'll be able to give us this much back. And if you're right, well, then everybody makes money. But if you're wrong, and many times they're wrong because we don't produce goods and services in a organized way, we produce in an anarchistic way, then you see these busts, right? And you also see that so much of this economic growth is buoyed up by the banks, getting cheap credit from the feds, getting really favorable rates. So it's not like, you know, they had some kind of brilliant idea and created goods and services that suddenly everybody needs and they're producing all this wealth. They just got cheap credit. It was a clever accounting trick that resulted in people like you, Brian, getting, you know, cheap loans, which then impacted the economy as a whole. But now when we're seeing the Fed raise those rates, when the credit isn't cheap, now we're seeing the cracks in the armor. Now we're seeing really what was foundational to this boom was that cheap credit, was that artificial prices. I think another thing to point out is right now, all the economists almost univocally say that the economy is booming right now. Unemployment's so low. Workers are doing so well. They have all this extra money. And yeah, what we're seeing is if you're doing so well and your jobs are paying so well, why is everyone defaulting on their auto loans? Why is credit suddenly becoming more expensive? And I think one person in particular in one of the articles I was reading made a really good point where they said, well, you know, economic growth and the improvement of the economy is just taken as gospel that this is a good thing. But typically, it only impacts those who own property. So if you own a business or a corporation like Jeff Bezos, or if you own a home or own equities like, you know, stocks and bonds, then sure, the economy booming raises the values of those and you enjoy it. But the vast majority of working people can't afford these things. They aren't able to start their own business. They can't afford to do that. They don't have stocks and bonds. They can't speculate on the market because what little extra money they might have, assuming they have it, they have to be real careful with because they can't afford to have it wiped out. And they can't afford houses. I mean, affording housing, especially in urban areas, is a dream. You know, most people are in their 30s and 40s thinking, oh, I'll probably never own a home, that this is just impossible. When, you know, 40 years ago, that would have been crazy that people that age couldn't afford a house. And yet that's what we see. So when we see this economic expansion, we see this growth and money being made, we shouldn't just take it as gospel. Who's making that money? And the truth is the property owners are making that money. And the vast majority of people aren't property owners. And so they aren't seeing the requisite increase in value. And that's a big part of why, even though it's, quotes, booming and everything's good, we're seeing everyone default on their loans.
You flagged an article for us, Daniel, that I think is very, very important too. And it's along these lines. And that is that a record 7 million Americans have stopped paying their car loans. Why would 7 million people just stop paying their car loans?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the reason why they wouldn't is they can't. This is an essential loan, right? They need this to be able to get to work, pick their kids up from school, run errands, etc. Many places don't have great public transportation, so you're really dependent on a car. I think of places like Los Angeles is perhaps the best known, but many other places have, you know, bad infrastructure. So just to get groceries and stuff, you need to take a car. Otherwise, you're taking some kind of 4-hour trip, which is not possible, or getting to work. So people aren't just saying, oh, I don't care about my car. It's not important. I want to focus on something else, because it also ruins your credit. Your car gets repossessed. You can get your wages garnished. You can get sued, all these other things. People don't want to deal with that. So they're going to pay it. But if they're not paying, it's because they can't. So they don't have enough money. So unemployment is so low, supposedly, and this is supposed to equal the buying power and the strength of workers, that they have so many jobs and such easy access to jobs. But the fact of the matter is, if all that were true, 7 million Americans wouldn't be defaulting on their loans. It'd be much lower. And I'd also like to point out, is that 7 million that haven't paid it for 90 days? I wonder what that number is if we looked at for 60 days or 30 days. You know, I think they do 90 because 60 or 30 might equal someone zoning out and spacing it and missing something, or, you know, not due to actual economic duress, but due to just not paying attention or having a busy month. So I think that's fair. But I think there's many right now where 60 days default that in 30 days will be 90 days default. So that's really a significant thing. So what that means is, when we talk about the economy booming, or we talk about the economy being good, and you'll always have elected officials, you know, patting themselves on the back for a strong economy, we have to ask, strong for who and strong in what way? And what do you mean by strong? Because right now, people like Apple and Jeff Bezos and Tim Cook, it's very strong for them. They're making money hand over fist. But if you're talking about your average person who needs an auto loan to get to work, it is not strong for them, and they are not seeing the same kind of increase.
Okay, let's move on to another issue. Let's talk about the broader economy. The Fed has been hinting at a slowdown for, what, at least 2 quarters now, maybe 3 quarters. Now it's more than a hint. Now it's signaling no more rate hikes until 2020 because the U.S. growth forecast has dropped so dramatically, despite what the president says about guaranteed 3.5% growth. It's just not going to happen. So talk about this slowdown.
Yeah, I think that's important. So how it works in the Fed, generally speaking, is if the economy is doing really, really well, if it might, quotes, get too hot, which basically means too much money is flooding them, or too many people are acquiring jobs and need to be paid in kind. And that puts a restriction on the money supply, because there's a lot more people who need money now because they're getting hired. And that creates potential for inflation. So this happened in the 70s, perhaps most dramatically, where all of a sudden prices went up dramatically because there wasn't enough money to go around. And so what the Fed typically does in those situations is they make money more expensive to artificially restrict the supply. And that is supposed to, quotes, cool the economy down. And then if the economy is really bad and doing poorly, then they lower the rates to make money more cheap, to create that boom cycle that we just talked about 5 minutes ago. What the Fed has been doing last year was raising the rates bit by bit. There was several rate increases. And what that signals to the broader economic kind of ruling class is, we think the economy is doing well, and we think it's going to keep doing well. And so we're raising the rates. And this caused Donald Trump to freak out and become furious, because, of course, it was hurting economic growth, which was so essential to his presidency. And he was kind of right, because what you realize is this house of cards was all based on cheap money. It wasn't actually based on a real economy. So when you start making the money more expensive, you do start hurting things, which we just talked about with regards to auto loans. So what the Fed is now saying is, look, we're not going to be raising rates anymore this year, because the Fed is realizing the economy is not strong like it thought it was. It is not doing well. Superficial economic data said it was. But they're digging into it and they're realizing, oh, no, there's a lot of cracks here. Well, if you're the Fed, the only tool you have is to raise or lower rates. That's all you got. And if the economy does badly, you have to lower rates. Well, prior to their raising of rates last year, the rates were practically zero. So you can't lower them much more than that. And so now what they're saying basically is, look, we've raised rates a couple of times. We're going to keep that in our back pocket so that if things really go badly in 2019, we can at least lower those rates that we just raised the year before. But really, this is all shadow boxing. This is, you know, a little thing that they're tweaking to try to influence the economy as a whole. And all it's doing is either, you know, glutting the economy with cheap money, which we're running out of, or, you know, tightening it up. But that's really all they can do. So what they're signaling right now is they see in 2019 and 2020 an economic slowdown on a global level, that we won't be growing the way we thought we were going to be growing. and they want to keep money as cheap as possible right now.
Let's move on to, as we are going through our allotted time, to talk about the issue of home building. This is one of the major primary indicators of the strength of an economy. And U.S. housing starts fell in February, and this was based on weak single-family home building. Is that not one of the early indicators of a coming recession?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about a slowing down in buying cars, right? Now we're talking about a slowing down in buying homes. And again, why are they buying less homes? Well, one of the big indicators is the interest rates are going up, so it's not as cheap to buy them as they once were. So again, people weren't buying homes because they were making some kind of astronomical salary that would allow them to buy these really overpriced properties. They were able to qualify for loans, so essentially banks were speculating on them and buying houses for them. But now that the interest rates are going up, even, you know, even 0.5% equals a lot of money over the life of the loan. Even though that number is low, there's a lot of money involved. And people are pulling back from that saying, whoa, it's too rich for my blood. I can't afford it. Well, like the auto industry, the mortgage industry impacts so many other industries, the construction industry, the industry, you know, that the lumber industry, the paint industry, the all these different industries that create commodities that build up a home. Get hurt. And then there's the whole finance industry and the insurance industry, and all these industries get in for the purchase or sale of a home. And we're seeing a rollback on those. So it's not just that, you know, people aren't buying cars or buying as many houses. They're also impacting the jobs of all these other people who depend on this industry to keep going, which is what we're seeing now. So we're seeing that weakening. People are pulling back. They're not buying as much. And that's what Brian was talking about earlier, where the market is glutted with commodities. They're glutted with houses. They're glutted with cheap cars. There's too many. And people aren't buying them like they used to because either they're too expensive, or there's more than is needed, or a combination of them. So these are all factors. We have the Fed over here stopping the rate raising. We have the auto industry slowing down. We have people defaulting on loans. And now we have people not buying as many homes as they used to. And all this is showing this slowdown in the economy, this end of this particular cycle, which I think we can point to one of the root causes is cheap money from the Fed. And I think we can kind of, that can almost, you know, sum up what we've been discussing so far, is that all this economic growth was predicated on this quantitative easing, on this bailout for the bank, on this, you know, ridiculously low interest rates, these really favorable conditions for banks. It was all predicated on that. And the moment we start reversing those policies, the moment we start unwinding quantitative easing and everything, that house of cards starts falling apart because we never fixed the systemic issues that created the crisis in 2008 to begin with. We just bailed it out. We put a Band-Aid on it. We kicked the can down the road. And instead of actually resolving the systemic issues, which brought us to where we are.
And, you know, this is a domino effect, too. It's not just that housing starts fall and people say, OK, big deal, housing starts fell. But then less and less lumber, let's say, is sold at Home Depot and Lowe's. People aren't buying nails or tools. People aren't going to work in the morning to build these houses. And there's this ripple effect through the entire industry, which then affects the economy more broadly. So just to say housing starts are down, okay, no big deal. That's not it at all. This is actually a very big deal.
And I think we need to see in the broader context of all these other issues we've just discussed over the last half hour or so, is all these, you know, no recession is monocausal. No recession happens because of one thing. We talk about 2008 like it was the mortgage industry. Well, it wasn't just that. There was so many other factors that went into it. And we're seeing all those factors starting to line up. That's why you're seeing such hysteria in this current administration. Trump's popularity was really predicated on his promise to revive the American economy, to beat up China and immigrants and really everyone else he could get his hands on so that, you know, your good, hardworking Americans got their jobs back. And if the economy starts to tank, especially before 2020 or shortly before 2020, you're going to see a lot of people turn on him because that's really the only thing he had going for him. And, you know, as rabidly loyal as his base is, I think you're going to see cracks in the armor where it's like, well, look, if you can't get me back my job that I needed so desperately, if you're not able to do that, what's the point? So there's a lot of political theater, too, with Trump fighting the Fed, trying to get them to keep down rates, trying to get them to fall in line and demonstrate that he's a great president and he can manage the economy. When in fact, what we're seeing is, if anything, he's done things that have aggravated the economy, that have made things worse than they are. The trade war is a huge one, the global crisis. cracks the armor, his lack of diplomacy or his ability to effectively work with other nations over trade deals and others is another big part of it, alienating longtime allies who we do tons, billions of dollars in trade with. All these things have aggravated the situation and accelerated it. And so what we're seeing is those chickens come home to roost. It doesn't happen in a month. It doesn't happen in 6 months. But give it a couple of years, and all of a sudden, you're going to see what this trade war did. You're going to see what its final effects are. And we're still just starting to see the beginning of it. And I think we'll see a lot more over the next 2 years, I'd say.
Daniel, we have 5 minutes left, and we have two important stories I'd like to try to cover in that time. The first is that that Uber, in its global effort to expand by leaps and bounds, bought a Middle East car sharing company called Careem for $3.1 billion. This makes Uber the king of the hill in the Middle East, does it not?
Yep. And this is Uber's model. So what everybody likes to talk about is how much money these tech companies lose. And Uber loses more money than everyone. It's you know, constantly losing money. But what you have to understand is the reason they're doing that is to undercut everyone else and to be able to monopolize markets by making it ridiculously cheap. I mean, I got home a couple of days ago from a trip, and it was late. It was after midnight. I went to call an Uber. It would have cost me $20 to get home. It instead it was going to take like 15 minutes for the car to get there. I was exhausted. I just hopped in a cab. The cab took me right away, but the cab was $50. And I was thinking, geez, that's such a dramatic difference. How does Uber make any money? Well, they don't. What they're doing is they're trying to destroy the other transportation services in an area. And then once they are the undisputed master, then they can raise the rates to whatever they want. If there's no taxi cabs to take or barely any, Uber can charge what it likes. And that's what we're seeing in the Middle East in terms of monopoly. They've now bought their competitor, so they're now an even greater monopoly in that region, which is the whole point. So now they can set whatever rates they want and they can profit easily because they won't be able to get rivals in the same way. So that's what we're seeing here, that growth of monopoly and that continuation of that process, which I think we've discussed a number of times in previous episodes.
Let's go to this last story. And this is one that I've been following closely myself. It's about the Sackler family. The Sackler family owns the pharmaceutical company that invented OxyContin. And they have been successfully sued for their role and their company's role in the opioid crisis. Now, that suit, I think, was settled just today for $270 million. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So the Sackler family has been successfully sued based on their contribution to the opioid epidemic and the many deaths that it's resulted in, the many lives it's ruined. They're paying $275 million, which is a lot of money. I mean, certainly I would want it. But the problem is, of course, they've made billions of dollars off of this. And the Sackler family, that's it, right? You pay the fine. Maybe you even fight in court to get it lowered. It'll probably not be the full $275. And then you move on. And the truth is that this is supposed to be, you know, this is being paraded in the newspapers as some kind of victory, some kind of like, you know, holding people accountable. But the truth is, you know, they intentionally created these hyper-addictive substances, lied about how addictive they were. Think of it like the tobacco industry. And people died because of it. And what happens? They have to pay a little bit of the billions of dollars in profit they made. They don't face jail. They don't face anything like that. If I go outside and I sell OxyContin to a stranger, I will go to jail potentially for years. My life could be ruined. They sold billions of dollars in OxyContin and they just pay a little bit of it. So the fact of the matter is $275 million is a lot of money. But if we rewound time to before OxyContin was created, they would have done the exact same thing because this was wildly profitable and the fine was reasonable. It was payable. So there's no reason to think that these sort of quotes punishments are going to be a problem for companies like this. It's not. It's just simply the cost of doing business. They're going to calculate it ahead of time and they're going to go ahead and take these risks anyway. And at the end of the day, the people that suffer are the users of these substances who are told that it was safe and not addictive and a doctor prescribed it and then in turn became hopeless addicts and, you know, have their lives ruined. So this is not accountability, unfortunately. And if we really want to stop the opioid crisis, if we really want to prevent the deaths and the misery that it creates, people need to go to jail. And I'll tell you, the moment, you know, board members go to jail or executives go to jail, you'll see things dramatically change over it. But until then, so long as we just find them a small portion, it's not going to result in any real systemic change.
40 seconds left. I want to note, too, that this $270+ million settlement is not going to the victims of opioid overdoses. It's going to fund a national study into opioid addiction.
Yes, exactly. And it should be going to the people whose lives it destroyed. They were the ones that were harmed by this, not, you know, a study group with well-paid research analysts.
Okay, we'll leave it there. We were joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. He joins us every week to talk about the economy, and he'll be back again in another week. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our regular segment, which we do every Tuesday, called Women and Society with Dr. Hannah Dickinson. In this weekly segment, we talk about the major issues, challenges, and struggles facing women in all aspects of society. Hannah Dickinson is a professor, and she is an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. Professor Dickinson joins us from Geneva, New York, and we're joined here in studio by Nicole Roussel. She is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. Hannah, Nicole, welcome.
Thanks so much.
Happy to be here.
Let's get started. There are so many issues again, of course. The Trump administration has broadened its attack on the Affordable Care Act Monday, telling a federal appeals court that it now believed the entire law should be invalidated. I think this is important, not because we at this show are great fans of the Affordable Care Act, but what Trump wants to do is make things worse. And again,
a lot worse.
A lot worse. And Hannah, as we talked about last week and in earlier weeks, we were defining what are, quote, women's issues. I'm using air quotes. And of course, those would be all issues. But in particular, the assault against healthcare, it's vital not only for men and women, it's also vital for families and for children. And as a consequence, for working class women in particular, the assault on healthcare is particularly egregious and burdensome. Let's just talk about what the Trump administration has in mind here.
First, agree, right? And maybe we can get in this conversation to talking about what kind of health care would really benefit women and families and improve significantly on the Affordable Care Act. But you're right. In this moment, the Trump administration is trying to go in entirely the wrong direction. And it is actually clear, I think, that this is not just an attack on the social safety net, an attack on people's health, but is an attack on women, that much of what would be repealed were the ACA to be repealed are specific provisions around women's health. So we would for sure see Medicaid coverage dramatically reduced, and that would impact things like women's access to treatments for reproductive conditions like breast and cervical cancers. You know, Medicaid pays for almost half of all births in the United States and covers pregnancy-related care for 13.5 million women. So, right, we can see just in those specific examples, you're absolutely right, Brian, that right, every issue is a women's issue. But here, actually, when we're talking about healthcare, there's some specific issues around cancer specific to women's bodies and reproduction that that we can see a real attack on here when it comes to poor and working class women who rely on Medicaid for staying alive.
Yeah, Brian, I think that's Brian. What you said is definitely true. The ACA is not the panacea that we need. It is a step in the right direction, but now even that baby step is, you know, being completely rolled back. The Justice Department has not yet made clear the grounds on which they're trying to roll this entire healthcare system back, but they will be doing that soon. But in the meantime, they have announced that they very much want to and think that the entire bill and system need to be completely invalidated. And again, you know, we were promised more, right? Obama ran on a single payer plan, on a real, you know, healthcare plan that would really get everyone healthcare, that would really be robust healthcare. And that's not what we got. But we did get some fixes, as Hannah points out. One report that just came out recently in a journal about medicine and about medical updates analyzed some of the things that came out of the ACA. And prior to the ACA, this report notes that women face challenges that discouraged or prevented about a third of them from getting affordable insurance and healthcare. And some of the examples were really fascinating and illuminating. A couple of the examples that were barriers for women were what's called gender rating, which is when women are charged higher insurance premiums than men, not being covered for pre-existing conditions, which can happen to everybody, but one of those pre-existing conditions is being pregnant, which can only happen to women or people with uteruses, right? Or being a victim of domestic violence, which happens far, far, far more often to women and happens a lot in huge numbers. And lastly, also being denied coverage for maternity care and contraceptives, right? So the people who bear children in this country are, you know, these are pre-existing conditions and things that were not offered healthcare for before the ACA. So while, again, the ACA was not a magic pill, did not do everything we needed it to do, it did some really important things. And I actually shouldn't talk about this in past tense yet. It has done many important things. And, you know, I am hoping that people will really fight back about this because it's incredibly important that we keep what we do have so far.
What's the politics of this? Why is Trump doing this?
Why now? I mean, we understand that Trump has always hated the ACA. I suppose that can be chalked up to ideology, but why now? After all this time, has he decided to turn to the courts?
That's what I want to discuss it. Like, what is Trump's calculation here? Usually when politicians are running for office, they promise people things.
Sure.
I mean, a lot of it is BS.
But normally one of those promises is not to take away your health care.
Yeah. So again, Trump is facing re-election in 2020. Half of all births are from Medicaid, which truthfully, I had no idea.
I had no idea either.
So what's the politics, Hannah? What's the calculation?
What is going on in Donald Trump's head is not always my best skill. But I will say that I think one thing that is important to look at is the amount of energy around Medicare for all or single payer health care at the federal level. And here in New York, we have some incredible organizing going on around the New York Health Act, which would essentially be a single payer health for everyone living in New York State. So to my mind, those things have to be connected. And I'm interested, right, in making the gender connection here. One of the things that a Medicare for All bill or single payer bill would do is make medical coverage independent of marriage and employment status, right? And so we know that historically, both marriage and eventually employment status, right, are strategies that are used to keep women in homes, in families, in marriages, in jobs that may be exploitative, that may be violent, that may be abusive, or that just may continue to reproduce unequal power relations in traditional gendered ways, right? So so I'm tempted to want to point to the ways in which Trump's attempt to keep those sort of traditional family values, like it's gross to even use that phrase. So let's think of another one. The natalist, you know, conservatives and reactionaries who want to roll back women's autonomy and the autonomy of working class people, LGBTQ people, trans folks, right? That assault, I think we can see it playing out in debates about what kind of healthcare people in the U.S. are owed and deserved. And Trump's version puts it back in the family, puts it back in this sort of individual mode where we know working class people are going to suffer and die.
Hannah, I totally agree. And I think what a part of this, too, is there's been a long narrative that Obamacare was expensive, right? That like people's premiums went up. And I have to say, I think that's true. We've seen numbers that's true for people who either already had insurance or for people who are self-employed or for, you know, kind of small businesses, smaller organizations. I think those premiums really did go up. What the ACA actually did really well, though, was actually cover people on Medicaid, right? Like get more people on Medicaid. Before the ACA, 40% of low-income respondents in one survey were uninsured, and that percentage dropped to 17% in 2014 and 11% in 2016. So for Trump, I think this is playing right into his base, right? He's able to really blame Medicaid recipients. He's able to say that he's cutting costs by rolling back the ACA because it was never, you know, these were all the carve outs that were made in the ACA were all made to the insurance companies. So we know that, you know, premiums can go up because the insurance companies are still in charge of all of this. So I think that's probably what his goal is. I don't know that Republicans in Congress are agreeing with this. I think there are maybe some who are going to face some pushback in their states, but that's my only thought.
Trump will also make the argument that he campaigned on the repeal of the ACA. He couldn't get it through the Senate. So he's doing it piece by piece by piece so that he can get on the campaign and he can say, Obamacare, the worst plan ever. They tried to hold on, but I relentlessly assaulted it. And he may feel, Trump may feel, that where there are a lot of poor people in so-called red states, meaning Republican states, those states are basically secure for Trump because of other issues that he, you know, his approval rating is about the same as it was 2.5 years ago in those states. So he may feel, okay, that's locked down. And as you're saying, Nicole, we can sort of demonize the poor. And there's a lot of racism in the demonization of the poor, even though the bulk of people on, the majority of people on public assistance in America are white because there's more white people. The imagery is racism. The imagery is targeting immigrant communities or black communities or people of color. There's another element of this story that I think we should talk about, since the ACA, the sort of the axis here is, do you defend the ACA or not defend the ACA? And of course, against Trump, these provisions in ACA should be defended. But there's another issue, which Hannah alluded to in the beginning, which is people are running for president, like Bernie Sanders, or I think Tulsi Gabbard as well, who are running for Medicare for All, right? Or improved Medicare for All. Now, here's an article from the anti-Trump New York Times from 3 days ago. And it's really interesting that they would do this. Here's the headline. Medicare for All would abolish private insurance. Quote, there's no precedent in American history, close quote. Unlike Obamacare, emerging plans would sweep away the private health insurance system. What would that mean for companies, workers, the stock market, and the cost of care? Then this article goes into a long, very long, protracted defense of private insurance companies as the anchor for the healthcare system.
There it is, right there.
So here's, I want to read a couple sentences. At the heart of the Medicare for All proposals championed by Senator Bernie Sanders and many Democrats is a revolutionary idea. Abolish private health insurance. Proponents want to sweep away our complex, confusing, profit-driven mess of a healthcare system and start fresh with a single government-run insurer that would cover everyone. And then here's the kicker. But doing away with an entire industry would also be profoundly disruptive. The private health insurance business employs at least 500,000 people, covers about 250 million Americans, and generates roughly $1 trillion in revenues. Its company stocks are a staple of the mutual funds that make up millions of Americans' retirement savings. So there you have it, Hannah. We have the Affordable Care Act, very, very, you know, uneven in terms of its coverage, much too expensive, not really ending or reducing costs, not covering everybody. The Democrats, finally, some of them have the guts to say, and it's only the guts because there is a mass movement for it, that there should be Medicare for All. So here you have the anti-Trump mainstream media focusing largely on an attack against the Medicare for All people, saying, guess what? If we end private insurance, which, you know, that's been biblically mandated, of course, it's the only possible system available to us. If we end it, millions of Americans are going to lose their jobs. Mutual funds that we rely on for retirement will be devastated. The sky is falling. And so the issue of healthcare is reduced as long as it's being conducted within and by these elite forces, Trump and the Republicans or the Democrats and the New York Times and the Washington Post, as long as the debate is constricted to those limited options, it means ultimately the primacy for the debate goes to treating healthcare as a commodity and as a capital generator rather than a provider for absolutely necessary health services for all human beings.
Of course, right? So you're not going to hear an argument from me that we have to scrimp and save when it comes to healthcare for people living anywhere in the world, especially poor and working class folks, right? But I will just say about that New York Times article that by narrowing our idea of the economy to major corporations and insurance industry and the stock market, right? We're talking about an economy that's not really the economy, right? Like, so I just want to share a couple statistics with you. For example, if we were to pass a Medicare for All bill that provided long-term care coverage, as most of the good looking policies would, long-term care coverage for elderly folk, that means that women who are the primary caregivers for elderly relatives might be able to work more than part-time, right? Or might be able to spend some time with their families, children, right? Not paying for childcare. So a quarter of women aged 45 to 64 are caring for an elderly relative. Just think about what it would do to have long-term care coverage for people's elderly relatives that would free up a quarter of women in that age bracket to do any number of things, right? Participate more meaningfully in the workforce in ways that pay them better, take care of work in their communities that they value. So that's one example. I think another example we should really think about here is, you know, with a kind of single payer plan, we would for sure see a decrease in debt and bankruptcy for huge numbers of Americans. I have more friends, right, who have serious debt from healthcare bills than people who don't. I think that's the reality of most of our lives at this point. And so here, again, just to emphasize the gendered component, women are 8 times more likely to be single parents than men are. And so we can just think then, huh, what does that mean about this debt? Medical debt for childbirth, medical debt from caring for children or oneself, that's following on a single caretaker, and that is most likely women. So I just don't understand. When we're talking about the economy and what is good for the U.S. economy, why are we not talking about what would be best for the economies of the everyday folks who live in this country rather than what's best for
companies? Yeah. Brian, I want to go back to one of the sentences you read where the New York Times addresses three primary issues that I guess it sees with actually having insurance for people through the government. So this sentence says the private health insurance business employs at least 500,000 people, covers 250 million Americans, and generates roughly $1 trillion in revenue. So the first part employs at least 500,000 people. Presumably, there would need to be employees in a single payer system. We would need people to do that. Also, in the bills that have been pushed forward that have Medicare for All, much, much, much lower down in this article, it acknowledges that these bills provide for new training, for income for people after they've been let go from the private places, that it essentially takes care of those workers for, you know, in getting them other jobs and getting them jobs in the new public insurance realm, et cetera. So that is no longer an issue. It says the next issue. So we have three issues: employs people, covers people, and generates revenue. First one, not really a problem. Second one, covers 250 million Americans. Well, the point of public insurance would be to cover all Americans.
Yeah, that's just a disingenuous.
I mean, that is
BS.
Clearly on its face, total BS. So we're left with the third thing, generates roughly $1 trillion in revenues. So again, what we are left with is companies making money off of this, and that is the only real issue here at play. It's so clear, especially like I said, when you read a little bit further down, you see that these bills are actually taking care of the former employees. So we're not worried about people with jobs. And then even further down, it acknowledges with, I'm quoting from the article, with a single insurer covering every patient, hospitals and doctors could spend less time and money complying with different policies, negotiating contracts, and filing forms to get paid. When was the last time you went to the doctor, those of you who have health insurance who are listening, and actually talked with one of the employees? And there are employees there who all they do is sit on the phone with insurance companies. Or, you know, you and I have to call insurance companies and wrangle to try to get anything covered. I mean, this would save so much time and energy and would be, you know, actually based on what people need, the healthcare people need.
Hannah, Nicole is just trying to make sense again. You know, this assault on Medicare for All by the New York Times, and Hannah's right, and we say it, all issues are women's issues, but there is a very particular impact on women, and some of the facts that Hannah threw out are so important. Like, the fact that most single parents are women, the fact that people are going bankrupt. These are working class and middle class and poor people, but especially working class and middle class people going bankrupt because they can't pay healthcare bills. That's 50% of all personal bankruptcies.
Can I just read one more sentence from this article? I'm so sorry.
Read that sentence, please.
Quote, while the bills would give relief to insurance industry workers, they would provide no such compensation for investors. Not surprisingly, the insurance industry and many other healthcare industries vociferously oppose these plans and plan to spend heavily in fighting them. I mean, that is just so, is laid so bare.
The investors, the poor, poor, poor investors. Guess what? By the way, Fortune magazine.
Which I love.
It's a cap. what do they call themselves? The capitalist tool, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, at the same time that New York Times article came out saying the sky will indeed fall if there's not private insurance companies, the Fortune magazine, same theme. This came out like 3 days ago. How Medicare for All could eliminate the $600 billion private insurance industry, as if that's like some great sort of intervener in the economy rather than a drain on the economy and a drain on people. I'm looking at an article by one of our close friends, Dr. Margaret Flowers, who deals with Medicare for All. And she is a pediatrician, so deals with children. Of course, as a woman and as an activist, she's been emphasizing these issues for a long time. And she makes the article about this so-called spending issue with Medicare for All. She said, yeah, there will be more federal spending for Medicare, but here's some of the facts. The United States currently spends twice as much as the average wealthy nation, over $10,000 per person each year. Unlike other wealthy nations, though, the U.S. leaves tens of millions of people without coverage and tens of millions more with coverage, but still unable to afford care. The U.S. consistently ranks low in comparison to other countries on health outcomes. Life expectancy is declining in the U.S. now for 2 years in a row. The first time this has happened in over 50 years. Death rates for infants and mothers in the U.S. are many times higher than in other wealthy countries. Thank you, private health insurance company system. I mean, those are the other facts that the New York Times and Fortune won't pay attention to. Go ahead, Hannah.
Well, so I just wanted to add another example into this conversation. One of the projects the Geneva Women's Assembly has been working on is working with some nurses and some patients and some community members in Penyan, a very small rural community that is potentially losing its inpatient mental health unit at the local hospital. And so these unit closures and hospital closures have been a problem in rural communities for decades. But one of the things I think that's so striking about this particular campaign to keep this unit open is the rationale from the hospital for why the unit has to close is because it's not generating a profit. I mean, can you just for a second think, you have a community saying, ooh, we can't provide inpatient mental health services because we're not making enough money. And then their explanation, right, part of the reason they are not making enough money precisely has to do with how difficult it is to manage the private insurance companies that they are attempting to work with, right? So this hospital doesn't have enough money to hire someone to make it their only job to manage reimbursements. And so they're losing money because the private insurance companies are not reimbursing this hospital. And therefore, their conclusion is, oh, well, too bad. Now there won't be inpatient mental health services for 5 rural counties. So another example of how when we think about health as a commodified thing and we orient ourselves around what the profits might be, we're actually making really insane decisions, right? Just, it doesn't make any sense to not have mental health services, right? And nor does it make any sense to imagine that that would make you money or that that would be your priority.
So Cuba, as we know, is a socialist country. I just wanted to read a couple of quick stats before we go on. Cuba is the first country in the world to receive WHO, World Health Organization, validation for eliminating mother-to-child transmission of HIV and syphilis. Cuba has also entirely eliminated child malnutrition, despite having sanctions and the blockade against them. And they also have a far, far lower infant mortality rate than the U.S. does.
Wow. Okay, look, this segment has gone so quickly, and we have, like, multiple other stories. But I want to, in our last, I think, 3 minutes or so, I want to talk about the role of NARAL, fighting for abortion rights here. That's a progressive cause, of course, a fundamental cause. But they're speaking at the AIPAC conference. They're joining up with this right-wing Israeli lobby, which is basically at war against Palestinian people, including Palestinian women and Palestinian families. Hannah, I mean, that was, I actually was stunned.
And has that happened in the past?
Go ahead, Hannah.
Yeah, I have to admit that I was a little bit surprised too, especially in this moment when we're seeing congresspeople and folks running for the 2020 Democratic primary saying they're not going to AIPAC, let alone not speaking at it, right? So here we have the California head of NARAL and the president of NARAL scheduled to speak at AIPAC. And part of the reason it came to my attention is there's been some really powerful online and in-person grassroots work to push back against this and make, I think, the really important argument that if we're going to commit to a reproductive justice framework, if we're going to say we're feminists fighting for reproductive justice, that has to mean reproductive justice for people all over the world. That can't just mean folks in the U.S. It can't just mean wealthy people. It can't just mean white folks, right? So I think thinking about the Palestinian solidarity and Palestinian occupation in a reproductive justice framework is really important. We know that the Zionist project uses gender oppression as part of its tactics, that part of the ideology is to view Palestinians as a demographic threat, right? That, like, actual conversations about birth rates of Palestinian women in some really, really racist, Islamophobic ways.
I mean, it's just ethnic cleansing is what's happening, right? And so NARAL actually speaking at this event is incredibly short-sighted at a minimum, but it's really just a lack of internationalist perspective and a lack of real clarity on what AIPAC is and what's happening.
And pure opportunism.
And opportunism.
I would say that. Anyway, we are completely out of time. It went so fast. We spoke, as we do every Tuesday, with Professor Hannah Dickinson. She is both an educator and an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. She joins us from Geneva, New York. And we were joined here in studio by Nicole Roussel. Nicole is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. If you enjoy this show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. If you subscribe to the show on those platforms, give us a good review if you would. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and Clear.